and welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of the Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Scotty Hertz, fully clothed, although I guess you would never know because this is radio, but it's a bit of an incident this week, which... it was bound to happen, right? It was bound to happen on a larger scale.
I mean, we've kind of venerated the idea, like in that BMO commercial where the guy's like, I only wear half an outfit now. And like that Folgers commercial with the guy who's only wearing a suit from the middle up. It's just, you know, we've been daring something to happen in real life and celebrating the people who don't wear pants anymore. So I hope those people feel vindicated now.
Bless them all.
I think that guy will definitely need to be blessed if he's going to hold on to a seat. Anyway, Open Sources is CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show. We are here every Thursday at 5 p.m. as we talk about the latest news items from Guelph, Ontario, Canada, and around the world. And we sometimes interview local newsmakers and politicians, which this week will be Ward 6 Councillor Dominique O'Rourke. And we're going to talk about all sorts of things. COVID and ward maps and traffic. It's going to be great. Anyway, that will be at the bottom of the hour. Before that, we're going to talk about the dueling left-wing party conventions this past weekend. The Liberals want UBI, and they don't want to tax the rich. Meanwhile, the NDP wants a working IT department, and we will talk about that. But first, COVID is back in the news. Not that it ever really left, but it is getting worse and not better. It's definitely worse today with over 4,700 new cases, which is a new record for new daily cases in Ontario and the second time we've broken the record this week. So, not good.
No, and it looks like it's only going to go higher. Sad to say, proof that, you know, some of the... People know that I'm not big on the lockdown denialists by any means, but there's something to it when we are supposed to be in, and I'm doing air quotes, which no one can see, lockdown, but yet the case count is that high. So there's something else wrong with this picture, obviously. It sounds like Sunnybrook Hospital was announced this morning. They're going to activate their field hospital that's been built because the pressures are that high. Sick kids... For the first time, by the sounds of it, in its history, we'll be taking adults. Mm-hmm. So making some capacity there to take people in because things are that bad. So when there are people, and there has been in town, anti-lockdown types who are like, oh, or anti-maskers for that matter, who are like, oh, no, everything's fine. Everything's not fine. This is probably the worst it's been. And what was the announcement today? 29 deaths, which is the high for the third wave. Most of us hoping at this point that this is going to be the final wave, although it's not looking that way. There were many predictions on this, too. In January, when the wave started going up again, I guess that qualifies as second wave, was like, you know, if we don't do this, there will be a third wave. Some of them predicted it bang on, but it was obvious that if we, with the variants on the rise, which seems to be the key problem here, that it's going to get worse. And it sounds like I guess it was in Toronto. I'm not sure if this figure was for the whole province, but the highest numbers, and this isn't to blame young people at all, but it is surprising lots of people that it is the 18 to 24 age group that have the highest percent that are testing positive. So as we are seeing here that as the variants go through, work through the population, not only is it younger people, younger than seniors and long-term care people that were dying and being hospitalized last time, it's 40-ish, 50-ish people in that range, and even younger. Mm-hmm. So if this isn't full-on red alert beyond the lockdown, and I'm doing air quotes again because I don't, some people know this, but I am classified as an essential worker. There's a lot that's changed out there, but I still get up every day and go to work. Whether I like it or not, I have to do that and still not vaccinated, but I guess we'll get to that. Not me personally. I just mean vaccinations. Anyway.
Well, it's, I mean, it's a mess, and there are some. It comes down to, we have a situation again where, and I just got the statement from our MPP Mike Schreiner, and it says more game show tactics from Ford, which is more or less accurate. It, you know, he's talking about, we're going to meet with the cabinet today and come up with, you know, new directions, and we're going to release new modeling data tomorrow and, like, wait until you see it. It's a lot of this stuff. And he was in question period today, you know, attacking Andrea Horvath for asking questions and holding the government to account, which is, like, her job. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I understand that no one likes being criticized, and no one likes being, you know, attacked, and, you know, everyone's trying their best. But there are some really big, serious questions provincially looking at the response. And one of them happened on Monday. They come out on Monday. They have this big announcement. Again, it's like 45 minutes late from when they said they were going to have the announcement. They come out 45 minutes late, which, you know, does not bolster confidence, because it suggests that they are literally making up the direction as they go. And to add further proof of that, they come out Monday at 3:00, and they say, oh, there's going to be no more school once April break is over. It's going to be all remote learning. And immediately people jumped on the fact that on Sunday, the Minister of Education sends a letter out to parents that says, when April break ends and kids come back to school, we're going to do A, B, C, and D. So what happened in 24 hours, if not less than 24 hours, to make them go, school's open, school's closed?
Yeah, you have to wonder as to whether it's a communication problem.
Yeah.
Or things change that rapidly, but it's not the case. This the writing has been on the wall that this was coming for ages, and it was clear on the weekend, and it was clear prior to the weekend that there was, or is, there's no was, it is a problem, right? Mm-hmm. So, and then, of course, that throws everything into chaos as well for parents making arrangements. I mean, they knew the break was coming, right? But it's the period beyond that that it's like, once again, things are thrown into turmoil, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
Most would agree that restrictions are required, but at the same time, you need to accommodate, or at least be mindful of people's lives and what they have to do and coordinate, accommodate. You can't just say, like you say, school's open one day and then the next day closed. And then, of course, sort of a sidebar to that is the talk brewing about getting teachers vaccinated, people who work in schools vaccinated, all of those people vaccinated, which I think the government will probably try and drag their heels as much as possible on, because, as I've said before, they hate teachers and anybody in the education profession. We're seeing that with Laurier, but again, that's another story. But it's an extension of this story, I believe, anyway, as people probably know, that I see it all as connected. Is that going to happen? We're still having this back and forth on the vaccines are there, the vaccines aren't there. You look at the main vaccine number and say, there's a million vaccines there. They're not getting into arms for some reason. Do you blame the feds? I know that Jason Kenney is doing that with abandon, but he is doing that. Ford's trying to be a little bit more cordial about it. I think he still likes to take a jab, but it's like, well, we don't have the vaccines. It's like, the physical numbers say that you have the vaccines, but yet Scarborough is out, tapped out. I guess the great coordinator, Hillier, who ran away at the end of the month, end of last month, is this the legacy? I can't remember the name of the new person who is actually a doctor.
He's the head of Orange. Yeah.
Yeah. So he has, any head of Orange would definitely have logistical experience, of course. I'm not envious as to what they've inherited, but at the same time, you know, how much of this province and country and the world runs on logistics? Mm-hmm. You know, if it's a question of getting X amount to Y, like, we're designed to do that. We can do that. So is there more to it than that? I want to know what I'm missing here. If the numbers say the vaccines are there, and then there have been obvious problems with the hold on AstraZeneca and now on Johnson & Johnson, although it sounds like, I've heard anecdotally, a lot of people just going to local pharmacies and Zares, and they're there for something else, and they're like, hey, do you want a vaccine? and they get vaccinated. So it's that simple, right? It's there's so many channels leading to the what is supposed to be the singular path that we're supposed to be on. It's like, let's get everybody possible vaccinated, particularly those that are considered essential, people that are at risk. But it's just kind of like, well, yeah, you're there, you can get a shot, but then you sign up for the system and 6 weeks later, you're still waiting. It's like, what is going on? There's too many variables here. Absolutely too many variables, in my opinion.
Well, there's also the whole thing with them identifying hotspots, and CBC and the Ottawa Citizen both kind of investigated this. And in Ottawa, there was a postal code in Kanata that was chosen, represented by the Minister of Long-Term Care, by the way.
Ah.
And, you know, they asked, like, well, why was this riding chosen when, you know, there's the outbreak isn't as high there? And it's like, well, because of historical data, because there's a lot of congregate care settings in long-term care homes. And it's like, well, okay, understood, but almost all the long-term care homes are fully vaccinated now, and the congregate settings are currently being vaccinated in the current phase of the pandemic. So again, why was this postal code chosen? And then there was a case in York region. There was two ridings in... Well, there was a riding in Richmond Hill, and then there was two postal codes in the next town over that were chosen, again, represented by PCs. And again, I hate Markham as a city. I hate thinking this way because this is like getting into tinfoil hat territory. But you have to wonder, why are these three postal codes chosen when York Region Public Health, they've produced a top five list of the top five postal codes that should get immediate vaccine rollout, and the three that the Ontario government identified aren't on York Region's top five? And who would you trust more to know where the worst hotspots are in a region, the Ontario government or the regional public health? Well, and then, I mean, I'll leave that hanging out there. But then you have Andrea Horvath, who I concede is probably not the best opposition leader there has ever been, but she's clearly getting under people's skin because she gets up like, what's the deal? And Christine Elliott gets up, goes full Karen, and says, how dare you? How dare you imply we're playing politics? And it's like, then what is it then, Christine? Like, what is going on here that postal codes that shouldn't be identified as hotspots are being identified as hotspots and are coincidentally being represented by members of the governing party? And again, I hate thinking this way. I think a lot of rational people hate thinking this way because of the tinfoil hat brigade that have gotten so much attention on this. But the question needs to be asked, are we identifying things through science, or are we being reactionary and just, you know, trying to get through this with a lick and a promise and just throw the blame on Justin for not getting us all the vaccines we want? I think we know what the answer might be after this week, especially.
I think if the response is that kind of indignant, then it's probably, there's probably some truth to it. There's a memo somewhere, right? There's a memo somewhere that will say, we've redlined these or red zone these. I love the technical term. It's the forward sortation area, right? So they say within this slice, because that's just the way the nation is divided up for postal codes, the first three digits represent like a block, almost like a riding, but it's smaller related to mail. So it's like, okay, those people, send them, right? I definitely think there's something to it. And as you say, with Andrea Horvath, she is doing her job. It is her job to do this. Now, as to whether it seems a bit over the top or whatever, that doesn't matter. It is always the opposition's job to ask questions regardless of who they are, and you can bet if the tables were turned, the questions would be similar, or it would be, like you say, getting put back on the feds, which seems to be the default. And then the feds will say, well, it's the province's responsibility, and there's this back and forth. It doesn't accomplish anything between all three, four parties and those levels, and bringing in the health department to her apolitical, you would hope. None of this helps. So regardless of where you draw the line should be, the where the cases are, right? And that might not necessarily be postal code or forward sortation area. There's something to that. But if there are zones, like, for example, the Amazon warehouses in Mississauga and Brampton, it's like, you set up there, whether it's at the entry gate or wherever, vaccinate all of those people. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, they should be vaccinating people at the bus terminal. And I know that sounds ridiculous. If there are places where these things are going to spread, they lost somebody in Brampton, right? Mm-hmm. A bus driver in Brampton died of COVID. Somebody at Canada Post, right, died of COVID. Go to Canada Post, vaccinate those people. Go to the packing house, vaccinate those people. Because if we don't do that, not we, if the province doesn't do that, and the provinces and the nation, if that isn't done, these numbers are just going to get higher. Everyone will say that, mm-hmm. except the people that should be saying that.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of Justin, he was the, obviously, head speaker at the Liberal Policy Convention last weekend, although he was not the only headliner. Former Bank of Canada head Mark Carney got a lot of attention. Also got a lot of attention that the Liberals voted in favor of instituting universal basic income, or UBI. That's about 73% of people voted in favor of that. They also voted in favor of launching some kind of Green New Deal, which I think is a phrase we need to retire desperately, that's neither here nor there. At the same time, though, they said no to a capital gains tax hike, and they also said no to instituting an inheritance tax. So Liberal policy is, let's help the poor. We're not going to make the rich pay for it, it seems.
Yeah, we're going to make the rich pay a little bit, or make the rich, like, say, Mark Carney, talk about it. Now, Mark Carney, as you know, was the head of the Bank of Canada and then went to the UK and was Bank of England for, I can't remember how long that was. He's back now, though. says he supports the Liberals outright, but he's being coy about being a candidate, but I'm sure somebody, either a handler or maybe Justin himself, are asking him daily as to whether he's going to run. And somebody like a Mark Carney would do rather well. I think Canadians, generally the Canadian voter, like and respect somebody like that until they get into politics. And then after a period of time, they're like, that guy's terrible. But for now, like, his star is, he is a shining star. And if whoever the parties can hitch to, whether it's Liberal, New Democrat, even the Conservatives, I bet you there's a Conservative operative calling him as well, because they all do this. They all do it. Now, as you say, there were the two conventions this weekend, all one. You know, I think the NDP were leaning a bit more heavily on policy than the Liberals, because the Liberals, from what I could tell, were talking more of the war footing and an election coming. They seem to be in that lane, kind of driving towards, yeah, there's going to be an election. And as we know, the budget is, what is the budget? It's April 19th, right?
It's so on Monday, yeah.
It's on Monday.
Yeah,
I've lost all sense of time and space. I'm like, April 19th, when is that? Oh, yeah, it's next week. So there is a possibility with every budget, because it is always a confidence motion, that the government could fall next week. It is a possibility. Is it going to happen? Not sure yet, but there was definitely something very stump speechy about Justin and everything that was coming out of the Liberal wing. Or the Liberal convention, which is, again, convention should probably be in quotes too, because it's all this virtual stuff these days, right? Mm-hmm. And the virtual angle didn't help the NDP at all, because it sounds like they spent, as you kind of hinted at there, a whole bunch of time just fraught with technical difficulties. People couldn't hear, and people trying to make points of order. And I'm sure I didn't follow it too closely, but I'm sure the point of order was, I can't hear you, or, and then, because, believe me, I have traveled in some of these circles and related, and it's like, yeah, that's, and somebody be like, that's not a point. But a very formal process in this new era I don't think it necessarily works the same way. But also there was some question about accessibility too, which came up. It's like, there are people with accessibility issues that aren't quite getting this convention. So Liberals seem to smooth sailing on the tech department. NDP should probably Get in touch with them and find out how they who they use, or are they in-house, or is it a contractor, unionized, I would imagine, if it's the NDP, and see if they can get them to run the show next time, because I don't think the glitches help them too much.
No, I mean, I don't expect everyone to have watched every second of the NDP convention, but I mean, if you watch some of it, I think you get the picture of a party that is, I hate to say, not ready for prime time, but from the technical glitches, from the all the points of order, from all like the complaints from people who were like, this convention should be postponed immediately till we get a handle on it, and then people talking about which accessibility. I don't want to mitigate the issues of accessibility too, but the picture coming out of the convention is this is a bunch of well-meaning people who can't organize worth a damn, and if they can't organize themselves, how the hell are we going to expect them to organize a government? It just, you know what? Not everyone may like the liberals, may agree with them, not trust them to execute on progressive policy, but competency counts. It was the show. The show went off without a hitch, and I think you're right about Mark Carney. I think he's one of these people like Michael Ignatieff, who I saw an op-ed that made the comparison. I think it was on CBC, but he's just one of those things. Like, he's a name. He's a star. He was like the head of Bank of Canada, so obviously those skills are going to be wicked easy to transfer to politics. Like, Bill Morneau. Remember how good that turned out. It's everyone loves him until he hates him, and it's just one of those things that it's like you want to institute like things like UBI, and you want, and to be clear, the whole thing about the inheritance tax and increasing the capital gains, that came from like the Ontario caucus. That didn't come from like super lefty places in like Atlantic Canada or Quebec. That came from Ontario. Mm-hmm. It just, the people who are going to stand in the way of that are the Carneys, are the Morneaus. It just you can't venerate the big banking people and the rich people and then say, and then introduce policies that will take away some of their wealth and expect them to like just sidle along with it. That's just that's not practical. So I mean, there's a schism there in the liberal, diaspora, I guess. That needs to be addressed. That perhaps doesn't get addressed because at the end of the day, they put on a good show as opposed to the NDP, which looks like a hot mess and was acted accordingly. So
well. Yeah, well, that is the centrist line, right? That is the line that they straddle, whereas, the NDP obviously further to the left of that line, but there is a ton of overlap, like you say, with the UBI and PharmaCare too, right? Is something that they don't. Put it this way, I think I'm pretty sure I've said this before, and I'm not alone in this. The Liberal Democrats would run Canada probably until at least we were dead, I would imagine. Unless they really, really screwed up in terms of numbers, which is generally around 60% of votes. I'm sort of spitballing that a bit there, but if just off the top of my head, if they join forces even just once, they would be unstoppable, right? They really would. Mm-hmm. But it's probably not going to happen within our lifetime, just because the Liberals have that foot very squarely in the. I'm trying not to sound like a Marxist here, but the capitalist realm. Well, it's Mark Carney, right? I mean, come on. It's, he's banker guy, but he does have a bit of that, let's call him social liberal, because we call the conservatives social conservatives all the time. Social liberal, where it's like, yes, I am Mr. Money, but we need to take care of these people. We need to take care of the homelessness issues. So you dip that toe into the NDP left, but not the far left of the NDP. So there is this range, right? It's a bouncing act. It's the same. Although they didn't have a policy convention with the conservatives as well, but they're too busy spending time on things like sex selective abortion motions, right, and ridiculous stuff like that that are literally wasting everyone's time. Although they are completely allowed to waste everyone's time because that's a democracy, and my opinion as well. But it's like, you know, you're considering everything that is going on in this country and the world right now, you are wasting time with motions like that. So that was the fight we saw. The liberals were going after the conservatives, and the NDP were going after the liberals, showing that, you know, the liberals and the NDP probably have way more in common. That is a hell of a Venn diagram, right? Mm. The crossover there is much larger than it is with the conservatives, and that's the line, right?
Mm-hmm. Democracy is meant, or let's just unpack that a sec. Democracy means being free to waste people's time, in the wise words of Scotty Hertz, and we will have to leave that there. Anyway, we're going to take a break and come right back with our interview this week with Councillor Dominique O'Rourke. You're listening to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio.
And that was our Royal Cat Records pick of the week. Royal Cat Records, the little big record shop, 21 Macdonald downtown. Pick up only these days, I'm afraid. And that was somebody who's definitely on a ton of vinyl and still giving it at 78, 77 years old. Sir Mick Jagger, backed by Dave Grohl of the Foo Fighters on every single instrument under the planet. He's literally doing everything else. The song is called Easy Sleazy. It's possibly one of the newest things we've ever played on this show, but yet it's new, yet it's old. Mick has discovered his inner punk rocker somehow, finally, and I don't know, it works for me. I don't know about you, but
it was pretty good.
Yeah, we'll just put that out there. But Dave Grohl, I think, is a quiet genius, and it was smart of Sir Mick to connect with him over however they do these remote recordings. One day I will find out. And that day will everything opens up again, probably. So anyway,
well, they probably did it through Zoom or Skype or recording their own, because these are guys who have their own at home studios, so that's probably how
special cable run between the studios, and it doesn't matter where on earth they are, they will get that done. So just snap the fingers, snap your fingers. Sounds like a Mick Jagger line, but anyway.
Well, we're going to snap our fingers and go to an interview that we recorded with Ward 6 Councillor Dominique O'Rourke, and we're going to cover a lot of ground with her, from traffic issues in the South End, which have been discussed at a recent council meeting, to redrawn ward maps, which are definitely going to affect her, because Ward 6 is disproportionately bigger in terms of population on the other wards, and even some COVID response stuff. And we will throw that to that right now. All right. So Dominique O'Rourke, thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure.
So I'm curious about how things are going in Ward 6 and in the South End. I have not been south of Wellington Street in over a year, actually. Paint a picture for me. What's it like down in your neck of the woods these days?
I think Ward 6, first of all, I would say if you haven't been south of Wellington in a year, please come and check out the trails in Preservation Park. I mean, we have this amazing jewel of trails and huge forested areas. So if you haven't explored those, then that's a real treat. So there's a lot to see in the South End. I think we're like any part of the city where families are readjusting. We see lots of people walking, cycling, you know, out on scooters, et cetera. People, I love seeing people using our parks at all times of the day, parents going out to throw a frisbee, you know, possibly between meetings, that kind of stuff. We're seeing a lot of renovations and a lot of home sales and a lot of movement in that respect. Yeah, just people, you know, continuing to buy local, to volunteer, to just hang in there, just like everywhere else in the city.
I've thought about Preservation Park, but then someone got lost there like last month, and then I thought twice about it, how susceptible I am to getting lost. But I digress.
The Arboretum is very safe for that, right? So also south of Wellington, right? Not city property, but beautiful to walk through the Arboretum. And I tell you, the number of people who are out on trails, and it's wonderful. It's wonderful to see, and I hope a lot of that sticks.
I'm not sure I've gotten lost in the Arboretum, but I do distinctly remember walking around the Arboretum Center about 6 times before finding my way back. speaking of the pandemic, though, and maybe you can respond to this as a member of City Council, but, you know, there's been a lot of, let's say, stuff shoveled on the front door of City Hall about the new lockdowns. A lot of that's come from small downtown businesses. Appreciating that this is a provincial order and you or the other councillors or Mayor Guthrie don't have a lot of power to override that. What's the best way that people concerned about this lockdown can be helped right now? I mean, how can you help?
So I really think what we can do to help as councillors is to help orient people towards the agencies that have funding for them or supports. And so the Chamber, the Business Center, Innovation Guelph, Lloyd Longfield's office, Mike Schreiner's office, they can really connect people in with rent support or income supports. And those levels of government have the capacity to do that. And the city really doesn't, because we can't run a deficit. And any money that goes out of the city, we then have to go back and get from residential taxpayers. So there is quite a lot that the city is doing. If you think about like the big picture stuff, what's the best thing you can do if there's an economic slowdown? It's infrastructure. And we're proceeding with two of the largest infrastructure projects the city has seen in decades. And that's the South End Rec Center and Baker Street. And people are very concerned about downtown revitalization. Well, Baker Street is going to bring housing, affordable housing, the new library, which is controversial, but the existing library is at the end of its life, not AODA compliant, and embedded in the RFP for the whole of the Baker Street proposal, right? Add to that, there's going to be underground parking there. So no one's really concerned about the $20 million underground parking. But so that is a huge infrastructure project that is important for economic stimulus and real downtown revitalization. So from that perspective, is the city continuing to invest in its infrastructure? The other one is there's funding now for tourism restart, because we know it's been so difficult for festivals and musicians and artists. And so there's funding for that. There's also funding for charitable organizations who have continued to reinvent themselves and to provide important services in the community. So, and they're doing that with a much smaller volunteer base. So I'm just a shout out that if people can continue to volunteer, it would be great if they could. Because a lot of people who were more vulnerable to COVID were that important volunteer base and were staying home. So please contact the PIN network and find out how you can be helpful, because the community continues to need services and help. So I think the city, where it can, is doing what it can, but we're not a higher order, we're not another order of government. And those important rent controls and income controls are important. And at the same time, we have limited resources in terms of bylaw. So when these things are happening and they go sideways and there's gatherings, et cetera, we are sending bylaw into those potentially problematic situations. And we want them to be safe as well, right? They are enforcing an order from another level of government that is a public health order that nobody takes lightly. So Is it tough? Yeah, it's tough. What can we do? We can encourage people to buy local. You know, those businesses that are shut down, buy curbside, buy gift certificates, you know, book appointments when they're open again, all of that. There's no question this is difficult.
Are you getting a lot of, let's say, input from people about whether or not the city's doing enough? Like, are you getting that on an individual basis?
Not really, to be honest. I really can't say much more about that. I mean, I will say that people are concerned about the vaccines and they would like to see that go faster. And public health is an organization that is funded in part by the city, but man, I think they're just doing as much as they possibly can with the vaccine supply they have, with the human resources that they have. And Dr. Mercer has said many times, if she has more vaccine, then she can ramp that up. And I think that's why they're encouraging people to pre-register. Anybody over 16 now can pre-register. They'll be prioritized in that database. You know, nobody shouts out the IT people who are putting together these databases. And, you know, so I think that is an immediate concern for people. I think people are a little concerned about gatherings and want bylaw to be able to be everywhere in the city, and they can't. And I think there is a bit of a new level of polarization that we're seeing with people, that people are increasingly stressed. And troubled by things going on. But generally, I think, you know, people just, they just want to get back to living their everyday lives. And the sooner we can make that happen, the better.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about some bare knuckle politics. One of the things that's coming up, and this is kind of going to affect your area directly, the redrawing of the ward maps. I do want to talk about the other piece of this first, which is about the councillors themselves. And you are a good person to ask because this is your first term. You ran for council with the expectation it is phrased as a part-time gig. I've talked to many councillors over the years who say the workload is not part-time, but, you know, given what you have experienced this year or this term, are you comfortable saying that this is a full-time job and should be treated as such?
So I think that if we want to go and call it a full-time job, it is definitely a three-quarter 80% job for sure. There's no question about that. And I don't think the bulk of the work is based on the size of the ward, though. I don't think it's population based. It's primarily issue based. So you hear a lot when there's an issue of concern for people. That said, I ran in part because Ward 6 has 10,000 more residents than Ward 3, had no rec center, has fewer civic amenities and programming. So for the size of its population and the growing population, I think that ward boundary redistribution is really important. I think if we want to say, look, it's a full-time job, then we need to know what it is that we want to be doing, because it's not just what you see at council. It's the prep for that. It's the reading the budget. It's the being familiar with the official plan. Like, so in my first year, I probably read easily 10,000 pages, like easily. It's also an agency board or committee that you sit on and whatever subcommittees there. I now chair IDE, which has additional prep. So to really be full-time then, what is that expectation of the work that's going to take place? Because our job is not to supervise staff. Mm-hmm. It's not to become a subject matter expert in a particular area. Although in some cities they have counselors who sit on a transit advisory group, et cetera. There is a push now to say, well, can't the counselors sit on some of these advisory committees? Well, we can, but we have to decide, do you want a governance body, right? A policymaking governance body, roughly 20 hours a week, and this is what we're willing to pay for it. Is that what people want? Or do they want somebody who is actively communicating, actively attending events, lots of committees? So we need to know how that looks different, right? I will say, though, I do have a concern when we, if slash when we stay part-time. The only people who can do this work part-time are people who are going to be flexible enough to then take Mondays off from their job for committee the whole, increasingly for committee meetings in the afternoon, for the budget meetings, for some of the briefings that take place, right?
Mm-hmm.
So either you're retired or you are an entrepreneur and you can move your time around, or you are a certain level in your organization that you have that flexibility. But I think that leaves out a lot of people. Or, you know, you have a spouse who can carry the mortgage, you know, or a partner carry the mortgage, that kind of stuff. So that, I don't think that's a negligible part of the equation.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the map themselves, I mean, because you are correct, and it was a bit shocking to just see the numbers as presented originally, just how much bigger Ward 6 is. And I mean, and that's just organic from the growth of that specific area of the city. But are you, perhaps not to tip your hat, but have you seen a ward map of your ward, an adjusted Ward 6, that you feel... I don't know, might better might make Ward 6 a bit less unwieldy going forward if it is a Ward 6, if it's a 6-ward structure?
All my Ward 6ers, so I would keep them all, but I want to make sure they have the same kind of representation. And I think that matters around the council table because you know, a quarter of the population of the city lives south of Stone Road.
Mm.
And we haven't had sort of a balanced political voice around the horseshoe in that respect. So so while I would love to keep all of the Ward 6ers, I find the maps really haven't changed that much. So if you look at, there's final option 5, like all it does is it moves that boundary from Courtright to Arkell, which are all lovely people, but doesn't make a huge change. And currently the population within Claremaltby is quite low because that will grow in the next 30 years. And also you can't be too troubled by the piece that juts out that is the Hanlon Business Park and Southgate, right? So that's all industrial. So that's not a residential area. So I don't know that it's unwieldy at all. And I've said all the way through, all that I really want to see is more equity for voters in Ward 6. And we will definitely get that under all of the models.
Mm.
The next piece then, I think, is really up to voters. So I really want to hear from people whether they think it should be full-time or part-time, 2 counselors or 1. The 2 counselors, and you wrote about this, is very comfortable for people. Mm-hmm. But is not common in other municipalities, does provide more diversity of voices around the horseshoe. But when people say things like, well, if I don't like the 1 ward councillor, I can go to the other one, then that is a very expensive backup system.
Yeah.
It's also not clear to me. Sometimes people will say, well, why didn't you vote with Councillor McKinnon?
Right.
And you've canceled each other's votes. Okay, but if we're supposed to vote the same way, and it's supposed to work that way in every ward, then we don't need 2 counselors.
Right.
Right. So it's very interesting how people look at the voting and the representation there.
Yeah.
You know, if your MP or MPP is unable to perform their responsibilities for illness or whatever reason, then, you know, you don't have this gap. They have office staff, et cetera. We have no office staff. I actually don't believe that we would need supplementary staff, as was proposed in the first consultants report. The goal would not to be to have more staffing, to be honest.
Okay. I do want to address the traffic in your ward, because I know it did come up for a rather substantial discussion, although that was technically about process and not about the issues themselves. But I think people really want to talk about the issues. Because Downey Road, we've tried a lot of stuff with Downey Road, And it seems like none of it's working. And if none of it's working, I guess, you know, at what point is this more of a of an enforcement problem and not so much a problem of how do we design a road that makes people want to speed less, I guess.
So I'll say this about Downey Road. First of all, there's three ways that you can control speeding or behaviors of any kind. The engineering, so change the environment. $300,000 have already been spent on Downey Road for those deflections. Those speed humps are $30,000. Okay. So in my mind, this is engineering is telling us we've done the studies. This is what we recommend. The folks are traffic engineers and they're following the provincial guidelines. And they're saying for $30,000, this will finish that piece. It will slow the traffic down. And I am hearing from people at Teal and Milson that people are just whipping in and out of town and they're concerned. So for that tiny little bit to just try that, finish the solution, I think it's worth trying and to get the data. And so that's the environment piece. The other one is education. And look, people know they shouldn't speed. So how much education can we do? Plus some of the education are those speed signs. So you're going 54 and a 50. So they actually do work, those speed signs. So there's an education piece there. But, you know, we can't put them on every street where they're speeding. And the people speeding are, it's us. It's people living in the communities, not you, Adam, because I know you're a transit rider. But, you know, but we have to check ourselves. The drivers have to check ourselves. So there's the education piece and then there's the enforcement piece. So Guelph Police have beefed up their traffic enforcement. They also can't be everywhere, right? They get pulled off traffic stops to go to collisions. So the expectation that we can have enforcement everywhere is not accurate. But I will say that the city has been part of a working group for automated, I'm going to get the acronym wrong, but automated speed enforcement. And that is becoming increasingly popular. So we're on the list, but we're not one of the pilot municipalities. We're on the list. So just like the red light cameras that are coming, we will at some point in time, in fact, there's a report coming to council June, so spring or summertime, around what that would look like. That's going to go first in school zones. Look, people going 70 in school zones is ridiculous and really inexcusable. Like, I got no patience for that. Somebody passed me. I was going 30 in a school zone and they passed me on the left in front of a school. Like, come on. Where do you have to be speeding like that? So automatic speed enforcement, and we will be able to designate community enforcement zones. So getting back to Downey, if Downey is determined to be priority in the city for community enforcement zone or automatic speed enforcement, then, you know, we'll have the data. Did the speed humps work? And if not, if so, great. And if not, take them out. And we have that opportunity, but that won't be for a couple of years. So I supported proceeding with that. You know, let us put in the last piece of the engineering that we think will work. They are temporary and there may be another solution coming down the pike, but in the interim, they will reduce speeds.
Do you think there's a, an element of this that it's like, I mean, especially in school zones, because we've seen a lot of, at least in the police blotter anyway, that, you know, we have people passing buses and people running past crossing guards. And it's just like schools are closed. It seems like schools are closed most of the time now anyway. And then people seem to forget that there is there are these rules regarding school routes that people seem to be not, but perhaps not remembering or at the worst ignoring.
Yeah, I don't think you've ever heard me in 2.5 years say that things make me angry. That really makes me angry. There's a child who died in Hamilton because somebody went around a crossing guard. There's no excuse for it. Full stop, period. I mean, we've had a number of people hit in crosswalks in Guelph and fatalities. You're in charge of that however many ton vehicle. and you don't get to go around the crosswalk, and you don't get to blow past people. That makes me angry.
Mm-hmm. Before we run out of time, perhaps really quick, we had that the decision on the Parkview Motel supportive housing project this week. I don't know about you, but I was kind of surprised there were no kind of negative delegates who spoke to the decision report. From your point of view, do you think the city's communications on the project was just that good, or did those people who were negative on the project give up?
No, because we received quite a bit of correspondence. We received a lot of correspondence in the first statutory public meeting, and the position of those people was clear. I think city staff did a fantastic job in their planning report that we are just not allowed to discriminate based on who may live there. I think that the county coming on board with funding is a great sign. We know that it's currently being used as overflow for a shelter and has been for a very long period of time, and that it's going to create more secure housing for people. What is better, to be cycling people through there every 2 weeks or to have somebody? And Sister Christine Leiser spoke, and she said people will be able to put picture frames up and nap when they want and close their door, which I think actually provides more stability for that community.
Yeah. That was a really great delegation. And I think that probably, if the deal was not sealed until then, I think that probably sealed the deal. But we will have to seal this interview off. Dominique O'Rourke, thank you so much for all your time today.
My pleasure. Take care, Adam. Thanks for all your work.
All right. And that was City Councilor Dominique O'Rourke. And fun fact, she was like one of the last guests we had in studio before, you know, everything happened.
So we're working our way back around.
Almost everyone we had on last year was recorded remotely, just like this. But
and there's still some shy types out there. So if they're listening,
yeah,
you're still more than welcome to join Adam, at least, and both of us.
Maybe they'd rather talk to you. Maybe that's the
secret. Oh, I don't think so.
All right.
Jointly. It works best jointly. You know, we all miss the studio. We all miss the way things were. But life goes on, as they say, and we got to keep on rolling, right?
Life goes on. The show goes on. CFRU goes on. That's it for this episode of Open Sources Guelph, though. You can stay connected to us at our website, opensourcesguelph.com. We're on Facebook at Open Sources Newswire and on Twitter at @OS_Guelph. Listen to the show again every Monday at the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean or through your favorite podcast app at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. Me, myself, I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can find my news and politics site at guelphpolitico.ca.
And I'm Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter. And you can find out more about CFRU, what we do, scheduling information, when things are on, and who's who at CFRU.ca.
Who's who? Anyway, that's an owl joke. Stay tuned for DJ Sounds Good to Me here at the top of the hour on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We will be back, of course, next Thursday at 5 p.m. for more of those open sources, and we will see you then.